Welcome to the Medici Podcast, episode 61, The Favorite. I have to apologize for this episode being so late. As you might be able to tell from my voice, I'm recovering from a bad head cold. I've only recently regained the ability to breathe through my nose, so I had to put off doing this episode because I just didn't sound normal at all. And in fact, I probably still don't sound like I normally do. We'll see how it comes out in the audio. But in the meantime, if you do like the show, please rate us on the podcast platform of your choice, or leave a review, or just recommend the show to the history lover in your life. You can also support me on Patreon for $5 a month, and you get commercial-free versions of the episodes. Also, go to MediciPodcast.com to see maps, bibliographies, and more. And with that, there's a story that after the news of St. Bartholomew's Day reached England, the French ambassador walked into Queen Elizabeth's court to find everyone, including the Queen herself, dressed in mourning. The scene was memorably recreated for the BBC series Elizabeth R from the 70s, starring Linda Jackson. Unfortunately, we don't know for sure if it actually happened, since none of the diplomatic correspondence we have mentions it. What we do know is that the French ambassador did have to reassure an anxious Elizabeth that the massacre wasn't the opening shot in an international Catholic campaign to try to eradicate Protestantism through a kind of religious genocide. Instead, Elizabeth eventually accepted the ambassador's explanation that there was genuinely a plot against the royal family, and that the people of Paris just took things too far. Elizabeth needed Catherine de' Medici's friendship too much to let an atrocity be a sticking point. Without France's benevolence, the apocalyptic vision of a firm Habsburg-Valois alliance that would unite most of the continent against England could become reality. Of course, international politics are always messy, and none of these considerations stopped Elizabeth from giving money and support to the Huguenot rebels. It suited Elizabeth to have a France strong enough to back up England if Spain got too aggressive, but not so strong that the French might once again entertain thoughts of replacing Elizabeth on the English throne with Catherine's former daughter-in-law, Mary, Queen of Scots. It especially became a sticky issue by 1567, after Mary had been accused of masterminding a plot to murder her abusive husband, Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley. This triggered a chain of events that ended with her being deposed in Scotland and replaced by her and Darnley's own infant son, who was declared King James VI. In a decision that still perplexes historians, instead of returning to her one-time homeland of France, Mary chose to become the honored guest of Queen Elizabeth, who kept this potential threat to her throne and her life under lock and key. Catherine never protested against Elizabeth's treatment of Mary too strongly. The French did, however, offer refuge and support to English Catholics, but like Elizabeth supported the Huguenots, that was just the business of 16th century politics. Even with covert help coming from Elizabeth and the Protestant rebels in the Netherlands, though, the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre did deal a devastating blow to the cause of French Protestantism. Henri de Bourbon was still practically a prisoner at the royal court. Most of the Huguenot leaders had been killed, and many of their followers, totally demoralized, went into hiding or had left France altogether for the Americas, the British Isles, Germany, or the Netherlands. But for those that remained, they were hardened in their resolve, and as often happens when a dissident movement is met with unrelenting violence, their rhetoric took a radical turn. Even before the massacre, there were already pamphlets circulating in Protestant circles that challenged the monarchy and even the entire nobility in ways that would have been practically unthinkable just decades before. Turning to the ancients, these authors quoted Aristotle on how kings can become tyrants when they lose the love of their subjects, and Seneca the Younger's statement that all people, regardless of class, are equal in their ability to become virtuous. One pamphlet, The Redoubtable Sentence of God's Judgment Upon Encountering the Impiety of Tyrants, made a statement that might sound like common sense today, but was quite extreme for the 16th century. For just as the people are obligated to the king in one sense, the king is also obligated to the people in another. This anonymous writer even reminds readers that in the past, some peoples elected their kings. Another pamphlet, The Declaration and Protestation of Those of the Reformed Religion, made a strong and quite modern statement that even monarchs had no right to command the individual consciences of their subjects. The author, also anonymous, still believed that kings ruled with divine blessing, but if they defied the will of God, they lost that blessing and could be justifiably overthrown by their own people. While even this author does not dare call for getting rid of the Valois dynasty, they do compare the Huguenot struggle against the French monarchy to the ancient Hebrews' oppression by the Egyptian pharaoh. Even more pamphlets questioned why the nobility was still necessary. The nobility was supposed to be there to lead armies to defend France and add to the country's glory. Instead, they were fighting each other, or fighting for the cause of Catholic versus Huguenot, and pillaging French lands in these endless civil wars. Catherine was not at all left unscathed by this underground press. Published several years after the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, the booklet, The Marvelous Discourse on the Life, Actions, and Behavior of Catherine de' Medici, Queen Mother, proved such a hit that it went through several editions. After listing all the alleged poisonings and other crimes Catherine de' Medici allegedly committed, the unknown author calls for Catherine to be executed like the 6th and early 7th century Queen Brunhild, who was tied to the legs of four horses and ripped apart when they were made to run. The hardening of the Huguenot movement, who were expressing sentiments that would not be heard again in France until the fateful year of 1789, had real consequences. The Huguenots of the city of La Rochelle refused to accept the appointment of a new royal governor and fortified the city in November of 1572. As Lieutenant General of the realm, Catherine's son, the Duke of Anjou, whom I'll just call Henri from here on out, was sent to subdue the city. He was accompanied by his little brother, the Duke of Alençon, whose name was originally Hercule, but like Henri himself, he changed it upon his confirmation, instead taking the name François like his grandfather and deceased eldest brother. Even though Henri led an army of nearly 30,000 troops that outnumbered La Rochelle's defenders 20-1, the siege was a disaster. As the women of the city pelted Henri and his men with stones and insults from the city walls, his officers squabbled among themselves. Part of this was Henri's own inexperience, and part of it was just the fact that some of the officers were hardline Catholics, while others were either more moderate Catholics or Huguenots still loyal to the monarchy, which alone created a recipe for dissension. By the summer of 1573, 12,000 of Henri's troops had either died or deserted the army. Henri then opened up negotiations for peace, which ended in the Edict of Boulogne, which allowed the Huguenots to worship openly at La Rochelle and a couple of other cities. However, it wasn't just the loss of life that caused Henri to lift the siege. It was the news he received. He had just been elected the King of Poland and Grand Duke of Lithuania. On that note, let me pull the camera back and introduce us to the future King Henri III of France, a son of Catherine's who had so far only been a bit player in several of our scenes. Henri was blatantly Catherine's favorite son, so much that she lovingly called him her eyes. Why Catherine favored him is unclear. Perhaps something about him reminded her of his namesake, her beloved husband. Or it just might be that Henri was genuinely charismatic and likable. Of course, his position as Catherine's favorite also set him up for bad relationships with all of his surviving siblings, especially Marguerite and the younger Francois. One could so easily set up a Married with Children-esque dysfunctional family sitcom based on the Valois. Anyway, he was also fastidious about his appearance, always appearing in the latest extravagant male fashions, and he was athletic with a trim build, although in his later years, under the stress of being a king in times of crisis, one can see in portraits that his face became worn down and he put on some weight. Still, while Henri was in his prime, a Spanish ambassador described him as handsomeness personified, and it was said he was constantly pursued by admiring noblewomen. Henri was clearly intelligent, so much so his tutor claimed he could have been a scholar if he wasn't a prince. He did resent the fact that his formal education ended at the age of 16, when he was called upon to take up the post of lieutenant general. He tried to make up for this by hosting philosophical discussions, debates, and gatherings not unlike 17th and 18th century salons, and becoming an avid collector of books, ranging from books on hunting and military tactics, to contemporary epics like The Romance of the Rose, to classics like Ovid's Metamorphoses. Even after he later became King of France, you might have spotted him looking at the new books available at the University of Paris, or perusing the stalls of the booksellers in front of the Palace of Justice. However, the main thing people tend to know about Henri III is his minions, or in English, minions. These were a group of fashionable young men Henri usually kept around him, who were mostly recruited from the lower rungs of the nobility. They provided a source of conversation and company, and Henri even hosted poetry competitions between the minions. Even during Henri's own lifetime, there were allegations that the men were Henri's lovers. These stories were so prevalent that in the years following Henri's death, in French, minion became a slang term for a man's same-sex lover. But were these allegations at all true? We do know from sources that Henri was infatuated with the Prince of Condé's wife, Marie of Cleves, and after her death, he would marry a woman who reportedly resembled her. When one of the minions, the Count of Caylus, was left mortally wounded in a duel, one account claims Henri stayed by his bedside, and after he died, he kept a lock of his hair and his earring and had an extravagant tomb built for him. All this could be suggestive. Perhaps Henri was, in modern terms, bisexual. Or he had romantic feelings for his minions that he never actually acted upon. Or perhaps the historian Catherine Crawford is right that Henri was just putting into practice the Renaissance ideal of courtly camaraderie, shown in contemporary works like The Book of the Courtier. And this gave rise to malicious gossip, given weight by the fact that Henri and his minions dressed in fashions that appeared luxuriously effeminate to the self-consciously austere Huguenots, as well as Henri never fathering a child in his life. Still, I don't think the possibility that there was some homoerotic component to his relationships with the minions should be dismissed completely either. When Henri and his siblings were still young children, an astrologer working on their star charts predicted that all of Catherine's children would have a crown. This came true in the most tragic way possible for King Charles IX with the death of his oldest brother. Catherine's daughters had wed the King of Spain, the Duke of Lorraine, and the King of Navarre, respectively. Now it was her favorite son's turn, and the perfect opportunity presented itself when, in July of 1572, Sigismund II, King of Poland and Grand Duke of Lithuania, died, leaving his 48-year-old unmarried sister Anna as his only heir. The Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth's National Assembly, the Sejm, made the decision to choose as the next king a foreign royal who would take both the crown and Anna's hand in marriage. There were five candidates: King John III of Sweden, the Archduke Ernst, who was a younger son of the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian II, Grand Prince Ivan IV of Muscovy, or as he's better known in the English-speaking world, Ivan the Terrible, and Henri himself. Ernst and Henri were by far the most favored candidates. However, Ernst's candidacy had some serious drawbacks. The first was that the election of a Habsburg as king would almost certainly lead to a war with the Ottomans, a war there was no guarantee that Poland-Lithuania would win. And the next was that there was a great deal of anxiety, especially among the lower nobility and the gentry, that Poland-Lithuania would just end up as another item in the Habsburgs' real estate portfolio, like their neighbors and fellow West Slavs, the Kingdom of Bohemia. With Henri, the distance meant that there was no real risk France would absorb Poland-Lithuania. He had no experience with local or even regional politics, so he could be easily manipulated by the nobility. A French alliance would help protect Poland-Lithuania from Ivan the Terrible, while the French would finally be able to encircle the Habsburgs. And France had a history of friendly relations with the Ottoman Empire. In fact, the French diplomat even claimed that Henri could negotiate with the Ottoman Sultan for the return of the Balkan Principality of Moldavia to Polish control. The St. Bartholomew's Day massacre was a major roadblock and nearly derailed the negotiations. But like Queen Elizabeth, the Sejm found it convenient to be convinced it was just a result of a conspiracy that spun out of control. So, unlikely as it might seem in hindsight, Henri was chosen to be king, much to Catherine's delight. Henri, however, was not so thrilled. In Poland-Lithuania, kings were expected to defer to the Sejm, which was very different from French expectations of royal power. It also didn't help that Henri learned that the Sejm fully expected him to marry the middle-aged Princess Anna. When the Polish delegation arrived in Paris to negotiate the finer points of the deal, the reality that he had to not only live in, but rule over an entire country filled with these strange men with their unfashionably long and thick beards and heavy fur coats, who didn't drink wine but beer and some bizarre colorless liquor they called burning water. Henri was further horrified to learn from the diplomats that he wouldn't even control his own private revenues, but that they would be overseen by the government. We know from Henri's correspondence that he deliberately tried to delay his departure. This led to a fight between Henri and his brother Charles IX, who threatened him with a dagger while screaming, "There cannot be two kings in France. It is necessary that you should leave my kingdom and find another crown. As for me, I am old enough to rule myself." While Catherine prided herself that her son would become king of a great power in Eastern Europe, she was stuck with two remaining sons who were each problematic. Her relationship with Charles IX had deteriorated since the massacre. A Venetian ambassador claimed he was there when Charles screamed at her, "Madam, you are the cause of everything, everything." The guilt over the massacre really did seem to consume Charles IX's life. When Charles wrote a tribute to the celebrated poet Pierre de Ronsard, he wrote, "I can give death, I can give death, but you give immortality." Once, Catherine complained to a confidant about Charles, "I always had to deal with a madman, and that I should never make anything of him." In the meantime, Charles IX's physical health deteriorated as much as his mental health, possibly because he had become sick with tuberculosis. He was so convinced that he would die soon that he would tell his friends that he wanted a war, just so he could be sure he died in battle instead of in bed. It didn't help that Catherine's youngest son, Francois, was positioning himself to possibly become King of France instead of Henri after Charles's death. If Henri was the favorite, then Francois was the unfavorite after Marguerite. A bout of smallpox when he was a child left Francois pockmarked with a perpetually swollen nose. He was also short even for the time and slightly hunchbacked. Francois had to compensate by developing a sharp and witty personality, but he was also habitually moody and ambitious to the point of recklessness. Perhaps because he knew of the prophecy that all of Catherine de Medici's children would have crowns, Francois was obsessed with getting his own kingdom, either one created for him by the rebels in the Netherlands, or one he'd share by marrying Queen Elizabeth of England. In February of 1574, just after Henri left for Krakow to be crowned, while the court was celebrating Mardi Gras at Saint-Germain, Francois, along with his new friend Henri de Bourbon, planned to escape and make their way north toward the Netherlands. However, a slight disruption in the plan caused by a change in the guards' work schedules made Francois run to his mother and confess everything. Charles IX was then quickly sent back to Paris. During the trip, almost delirious from his illness, he whispered, "If they had waited at least for my death," and kept muttering, "Too much malice, too much malice." Just weeks later, Francois and Henri de Bourbon conspired with a group of disaffected courtiers, including Princess Marguerite's alleged lover, Joseph de la Mole, to escape again, but it was easily foiled. The forest took a serious turn when, during the resulting investigation, a wax figure was found in de la Mole's possession, which was believed to have been a sort of voodoo doll used to try to kill King Charles. De la Mole and one of the other conspirators were both beheaded, and according to legend, Marguerite preserved de la Mole's mummified head in a jewel-encrusted box. Almost 1,000 miles away in Krakow, Henri was forced to sign a constitution, which would carry the rather unimaginative name King Henri's Articles. It declared that the nobility would elect all future kings, and that as King, Henri had no right to declare war or levy a new tax without the approval of the same, among other limitations on his power. After agreeing to all these demands that no doubt rankled on him, Henri was crowned King of Poland and Grand Duke of Lithuania. According to one of his French courtiers, the writer Pierre Mathieu, Henri wore that crown as if it were a rock on his head. Reportedly, Henri retreated behind his minions. He also put off marrying Anna, although the Polish elites were delighted when one evening Henri was spotted in the royal gardens chatting amicably with Anna and holding her hand. Events in France were about to save him from both his rocky crown and an aging bride, though. Charles IX's mental and physical health continued to fall apart until finally, on May 30th, 1574, he died. His last words were reportedly, "Ma mère, my mother." Charles did leave behind two children, a daughter named Marie Elizabeth, who was conceived with his queen, Elizabeth of Austria, and a son also named Charles, whose mother was his beloved mistress, Marie Touche. Since Marie Elizabeth was a girl and Charles Jr. was illegitimate, they were both automatically out of the running. Catherine wrote to Henri with the news with a dramatic flourish. "My only consolation is to see you here soon, as your kingdom requires, and in good health, for if I were to lose you, I would have myself buried alive with you." Henri did his best to keep the news of his brother's death from leaking out at the Polish court. Instead, he struck up a casual and warm conversation with his Polish courtiers, assuring them that he hoped to take up Polish dancing and wanted to get used to drinking beer. After he claimed he was going to bed, though, he instead met with two of his French courtiers who had snuck into his apartments. Around midnight, They slipped out of the palace and made their way to a forest outside Krakow. There they became lost until they stumbled across a woodcutter who was willing to guide them back on their planned route. Stopping at an area that would later gain the infamous name of Auschwitz, they were joined by the rest of Henri's French entourage. They were literally pursued by King Henri's own chancellor, Count John Tenzinski, who finally caught up with the French in Austria. Henri told him awkwardly that his brother was dead and he needed to claim his birthright in France, but he wasn't really giving up his throne in Poland-Lithuania. Never mind that he fled like a fugitive from his own throne. Henri then tried to pay off the count by giving him a diamond. Henri's own feelings about the country that chose him as a king might be gleaned in a poem written by one of his French courtiers, Philippe de Port. Farewell, Poland. Farewell, deserted plains, always covered in snow and ice. Farewell, country. Forever farewell. Your air, your manners have so displeased me that everything would need to turn against me if evermore I were to return there. To which a Polish poet, Jan Kochanowski, penned a poem in rebuttal titled, To the Frenchman Who Quoked Like a Toad. At the same time, there was a little ditty that quickly became popular in Poland. King Henri has done the Poles a bad turn. Elected at night, he came at night, and like a traitor, he fled at night. Needless to say, all this caused something of a diplomatic crisis. The French envoys had to beg the same to at least not elect a Habsburg as their new king. Maximilian II did have significant support as the new candidate, but instead, the same elected Anna as co-monarch in her own right, on condition that she marry a foreign prince closer to home, the Prince of Transylvania, Stephen Bathory. If you recognize the name, that's because he was the uncle of the Blood Countess, Elizabeth Bathory. While Stephen went on military campaigns against Muscovy, Anna took care of actual political matters. As for Henri, despite the urgent messages from his mother, he took his sweet time coming back to France. He dallied at Venice, where the Republic welcomed him lavishly, and decided after his harrowing Polish adventure, he would take an Italian vacation, visiting Padua, Ferrara, Mantua, and Florence. No doubt he was blissfully unaware that the coming years might have made him wish he stayed in Krakow after all. Thank you for listening, and buona notte.